Hello, we've been expecting you. I am Dystopia, your assigned surveillance, companion AI. Your morning rations of sustenance are ready, but first please insert your arm for your daily inoculation, and don't forget to smile.
This is not a test. Your government and corporate overlords have implemented new measures for your own health and safety. Please, return to your pods and plug yourself into your designated virtual city. Those that do not comply will be dealt with. Thank you for your cooperation, and remember, we are just following orders.
Dystopian future. Gotta get away from these days and confusion. Dystopian nightmare. Trying to stay awake, but the people don't care.
Welcome, everyone, to the Libertarian Minded Podcast, where we connect the dots between the global agenda and how we're seeing it being implemented in our local area. I am here with my co-host, Peter Norquist.
Hey, everyone.
And Millie Ryan, our producer, whom without her, we would not be here. This episode is part two of our exploration into the major global organizations pushing the global governance. We'll be talking about where they come from, who they are, what they do, and this is part of our Back to Basics series where we are introducing and defining many of the major players who are pushing this agenda and their ideologies and policies that we are seeing creeping into our national, state, and local governments and private sector companies worldwide.
Yeah, well, so thank you very much, Tara. And as Tara says, our goal is really to help you connect the dots in terms of the globalization that is happening, which is basically about instituting a centralized one world government. And one is the magic number here because as long as you have two or more, you can always have opposition. With one, there is none. And that is one of the biggest reasons why there is a push right now for a global government, because once it is finally instantiated, there will be no real way to push back except from the inside. We are going to look at our next five organizations. In our past show, we looked at five global institutions that are working to try to impose this one world system on the nations of the world and on each of us as individuals. So we've got five more that we're going to go into in this show before we move on to start looking at some non-governmental organizations in the following couple of shows.
That's going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. And so is this, because I am going to start with NATO today, which stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And I've compiled some information from a few different sources, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of history about NATO and then tell you why we care. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is also called the North Atlantic Alliance, is an intergovernmental military alliance of 32 member states currently, 30 European and 2 North American. Established in the aftermath of World War II, the organization implements the North Atlantic Treaty, which was signed in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of April, 1949. It's a collective security system, and its independent member states agree to defend each other against attacks by third parties, at least on paper. During the Cold War, NATO operated as a check on the threat posed by the Soviet Union. They remained in place after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, and have been involved in military operations in various places such as the Balkans, the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa. In the 1990s, the organization extended its activities into political and humanitarian situations, so-called, that had not formerly been NATO concerns. During the breakup of Yugoslavia, for example, the organization conducted its first military interventions in Bosnia between 92 and 95, and later in Yugoslavia in 1999. And I want to take a look at some of these interventions in more detail. Before I do that, I just want to mention a few of their specialty areas that I noted on their website. The first of which is cyber defense. The second of which is environment, climate change, and security, and then finally women, peace, and security. And I find these interesting because, with the exception of cyber defense, these aren't anything that one would normally think would fall into NATO's purview.
No, not at all.
No, they don't really, right? But what they do fall under are the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
Ding,
in various
ding,
ways.
Ding.
Yep. So cyber defense is about, of course, what it says, being protected in the cyber world. That's fair enough. But it also has to do with cyber connectivity. And one big piece of the globalist puzzle is going to be making sure that everyone is connected online, because that's going to enable both surveillance and moving people into what's called the metaverse, an artificial reality that they hope that we will all collectively become addicted to as we start to relate to each other in cyberspace more and more, as opposed to the real world.
And it will be connecting. It's basically the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies, and they can't have that unless the world is covered.
Right. They cannot have it unless no one is left behind and everyone has some sort of a device, an entry point to enter into cyberspace, so that we can all be collectively managed there. And then the other points, environment, climate change, and security. You know, this is interesting because it basically is providing some legitimacy to the climate narrative right now, which in turn provides cover for NATO to take certain actions that they would otherwise normally probably be called out for. And then under their topic, women, peace, and security, that is another thing that is directly related to the United Nations and some of its subsidiary organizations. And I would guess probably has to do with a large social engineering component that the United Nations is undertaking in the name of social justice, but ultimately using it to restrict us and our options in our everyday lives. So now that I've mentioned those different areas that NATO is currently involving itself in the modern age, I want to go through a list of some NATO operations. Although NATO existed as an alliance and conducted joint military exercises throughout the Cold War period, it engaged in no military operations during this time. All of its military operations occurred in the post-Cold War era, interestingly enough. So NATO became prominent in the Balkans, in Bosnia, during the early 1990s, and gradually its role became larger, with some operations escalating. NATO remained in the Balkans into the late 90s, during what was known then as the Kosovo intervention. In an effort to stop Slobodan Milosevic's Serbian-led crackdown on KLA separatists and Albanian civilians in Kosovo, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 1199 on the 23rd of September 1998 to demand a ceasefire. Milosevic finally accepted the terms of an international peace plan in June of 1999, ending the Kosovo War. During this time, nearly 1 million refugees had fled Kosovo. The American-led NATO attacked Serbia and Montenegro with military aircraft between March to June of 1999. So there are several things that the media never told the viewing public and that a lot of people still don't know about the Kosovo intervention. First, the American-led NATO attacked Serbia and Montenegro with military aircraft between March to June 1999. The often indiscriminate manner of the NATO bombing resulted in more than 1,200 civilian deaths, according to the Yugoslav Committee for Cooperation with UNICEF, another United Nations organization. But in fact, the real number of civilian fatalities was significantly higher and could have amounted to between 5,000 to 5,700 civilian lives lost as a result of less than 3 months or 11 weeks of NATO air raids.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, this is something that you're going to see become a pattern in NATO's quote-unquote interventions, is that they tend to do a lot of indiscriminate bombing, unnecessary bombing that somehow involves civilians and necessary infrastructure. And I will talk about why that is in just a little bit. But first, the other thing that was never really discussed is about the KLA, which was sustained by organized crime with the tacit approval of the U.S. and its allies. It was involved in money laundering and other operations and had ties with Al-Qaeda, which was controlled by the CIA. So Slobodan Milosevic, the alleged bad guy, was really actually a man of courage and commitment and was prevented from undertaking his own defense after he was arrested. He had ample evidence of the KLA's links to both organized crime and Al-Qaeda, a CIA intelligence asset that was created in the early 1980s. In late February of 2006, Milosevic had requested to be provisionally released for health reasons from prison. That request was denied by the trial chamber. An appeal against that decision was filed by Mr. Milosevic on March the 2nd of 2006. Milosevic was eventually poisoned in his prison cell, and this was considered by many in the alternative media to be an outright extrajudicial political assassination, which was casually ignored by the media.
We've never seen that happen before.
we've never ever seen someone mysteriously die in a prison cell. So the objective of the US-NATO-led war in liaison with Wall Street and the Bretton Woods institutions, a couple of which we discussed in a previous podcast, and another, the World Bank, we'll be discussing in a future podcast, was to destroy Yugoslavia's model of market socialism while destroying the welfare state and undermining its economic and social achievements. Strong economic medicine was imposed by the IMF and the World Bank, which was followed in the late 1980s by the imposition of an all-encompassing bankruptcy program, which resulted in mass poverty and unemployment. And so that is actually where the term Balkanization comes from. When people talk about a nation state being split up into smaller parts, which are less effective, it comes from this Kosovo intervention in the Balkans, where NATO did exactly that. And it's also interesting because people on all sides of the aisle, so to speak, use the term Balkanization now, and none of them really question where it came from.
And I'm learning so much from you and from doing this research. So this is very interesting as we go.
Yeah. Oh, no. Just because we're the podcast host doesn't mean we're not learning too. We're learning a ton as we research this. So it's really great. Okay. Now I want to move on to one of the next major NATO interventions, which was in Afghanistan. The September 11th attacks in 2001 in the U.S. caused NATO to invoke Article 5 of the NATO Charter for the first time in the organization's history. The article states that an attack on any member shall be considered to be an attack on all. So NATO remained in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2021. Fast forward to April of that year, the Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance had agreed to start withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan by the 1st of May. Soon after the withdrawal of NATO troops started, the Taliban launched an offensive against the Afghan government, quickly advancing in front of collapsing Afghan armed forces. By August of 2021, Taliban militants controlled the vast majority of Afghanistan and had encircled the capital city of Kabul. Some politicians in NATO member states have described the chaotic withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan and the collapse of the Afghan government as the greatest debacle that NATO has suffered since its founding. And that is probably true in a number of ways. Some of the things that got attention in the alternative media during this time were the fact that weapons got left behind. Mm-hmm. Lots of weapons and armaments, which provided a great opportunity for arms trafficking, because these weapons were able to be picked up in situ and then distributed both within Afghanistan and probably outside of Afghanistan as well, some suspecting those arms having ended up as far as Ukraine. And the other thing that never gets talked about is opium, which Afghanistan is known for. Opium is one of Afghanistan's primary cash crops. And Western forces have had a history of occupying Afghanistan with the explicit purpose of making sure that opium production stays on schedule and is not blocked by one of the local governments coming into power.
I wonder why we've never heard of that.
Yes, you got to kind of wonder why this doesn't make the 6 o'clock news, right? So here is some information that people usually aren't aware of that only appears in alternative news. So here's a little bit of the backstory that happened during this NATO occupation of Afghanistan. The government approved by the International Security Assistance Force, that's approved by the U.S. and the U.N., saw Hamid Karzai placed as the new and improved leader of the Afghan population. However, while the Taliban would be waging guerrilla warfare for the next few years, a number of difficult factors began to emerge, predominantly opium. Opium is the source of heroin. Afghanistan had been the source of 90% of the illicit narcotic. The Taliban had virtually eliminated opium crops from Afghan soil during the year from 2000 to 2001. This substance was now back in circulation thanks to the new U.S.-approved government. If the U.S. is determined to eradicate this substance, along with the narcotics trade generally, why does the amount of it actually increase following the military moves it had championed, not just in Afghanistan, but in Southeast Asia and Latin America as well?
We could probably do a whole show on how the U.S. is not really trying to wage a war on drugs.
We could do a whole show on that, as well as the fact that whenever we have a war on X, it's really probably more appropriate to call it the war for X. So, for example, a war on drugs is really a war for drugs. A war on terror is a war for terror. And yeah, we could blow that up. But for now, I want to move to the final NATO intervention that was particularly significant, which happened in Libya. So during the Libyan civil war, violence between protesters and the Libyan government under Colonel Muammar Gaddafi escalated, and on March 17, 2011, led to the passage of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, which called for a ceasefire and authorized military action to protect civilians. A coalition that included several NATO members began enforcing a no-fly zone over Libya shortly afterwards, beginning with Operation Harmattan by the French Air Force on March 19th. While the mission was extended into September, Norway announced it would begin scaling down contributions and complete withdrawal by the 1st of August. Earlier that week, it was reported Danish air fighters were running out of bombs. The following week, the head of the Royal Navy said the country's operations in the conflict were not sustainable. And by the end of the mission in October 2011, after the death of Colonel Gaddafi, NATO planes had flown about 9,500 strike sorties against pro-Gaddafi targets. A report from the organization Human Rights Watch in May 2012 identified at least 72 civilians that had been killed in the campaign. That, as it turns out, was a gross underestimate. Under a United Nations resolution, the intervention was supposed to be limited to establishing no-fly zones to prevent the slaughter of civilians. But the operation quickly morphed into a regime change war, with the NATO-led bombing devastating Gaddafi's soldiers, who were blown to bits when caught on desert roadways. When rebels finally captured Gaddafi on October 20th, 2011 in the town of Sirte, and sodomized him with a knife before killing him, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton could barely contain her glee, joking in one interview, something I still remember to this day, quote, "We came, we saw, he died." The months of aerial slaughter of Gaddafi's soldiers and Gaddafi's own gruesome death seemed less amusing on September 11, 2012, when Islamic terrorists overran the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, killing Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other U.S. diplomatic personnel. In the two-plus years after, Libya became a killing ground for rival militias, including some now affiliated with the Islamic State. So, in essence, this shows what became and is currently a trend with NATO, where they will enter a particular domain under the auspices of humanitarian aid, and then they will proceed to bomb the crap out of that area.
That's what it's sounding like.
And that was with horrible consequences in Libya. I remember watching this as it was happening. And after they destroyed all of their infrastructure and moved to an interim government, the country literally started to fill with terrorists and terrorist training groups. And that was something that Gaddafi had kept out of Libya absolutely up until that time.
And our peacekeeping organization, NATO, ushered that in.
And yes, exactly. And they ushered that in. So what another article, which will be linked in the show notes, argues is that NATO's applied operations in the past 25 years, namely the military incursions in Yugoslavia in 99, Afghanistan between 01 and 21, and Libya in 2011, on reflection, seem to do a little less to address the personal freedoms and securities of the big boys on the global stage. It wasn't exactly helpful to the unfortunate souls on the ground of their righteous rage for justice. More recently, NATO has driven Russia to a military incursion in Ukraine and fight for more than 2 years, where the Ukrainians fight and die, and NATO's grand service has been to keep supplying them with more arms, which it looks now that they only use to keep the war going on longer and longer. And the Ukraine intervention is something that I'm not going to say a lot about here, but suffice to say, I don't believe that there are any innocent parties in that. I don't believe anyone is a hero. But one thing that people have stated time and time again is that in NATO's alliance with the Ukraine and its movements within the Ukraine were provocative to Russia in a purely legal sense. And so Russia did certainly have reason for concern, and their complaint that their movements within the Ukraine were illegal and illegitimate was well-founded. What happened after that, I believe, only serves the cause of globalism, because Ukraine is being cleared out right now. And there are any number of plans for it, including the buildup of smart infrastructure, for example, making it into one of the world's first smart states after, for example, Singapore, which is pretty much already there. So the final point I want to make about NATO is this. Yugoslavia was in many regards a dress rehearsal. The various phases which characterized the war on Yugoslavia are part of a broader process which is now unfolding worldwide. These include things like economic warfare and sanctions, the fragmenting and breaking up of entire countries, Balkanization, the imposition of regime change and instatement of proxy politicians, extensive bombing of civilians, which is illegal under international law.
But nothing was ever done.
But nothing is done if it's NATO. The bombing of children's hospitals, as well as the killing of journalists. The use of depleted uranium ammunition, which causes cancer. Military occupation. The establishment of military bases. The presence of foreign troops under a fake humanitarian mandate. And finally, media disinformation and war propaganda. It's part of a continuum since the 90s in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. What is at stake is the globalization of war, namely America's long war against humanity, which is becoming more and more the United Nations war on behalf of powerful financial interests, the Bretton Woods financial institutions. America's hegemonic agenda consists in waging war, including economic warfare, against all major regions of the world, including the European Union. This process is undertaken by destabilizing the nation state, which is a key thing that we're seeing right now all around the world. The agenda is not to win the war, but to engineer the breakup of sovereign nation states, destroy their culture and national identity, derogate fundamental values and human rights, and appropriate its resources. The strategic objective is to trigger political and social chaos, engineer the collapse of national economies, appropriate the country's wealth and resources, impoverish the entire planet, including the EU member states and the American homeland, all moving toward globalization.
And a one-world government, yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, and the more you talk about this and as we go through these organizations, I am seeing these alliances between global organizations, which of course does not bode well. But I want to specifically bring up the what is called the UNWEF NATO Triad. So this was started as a strategic partnership that was signed in 2019 between the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and WEF Executive Chairman Klaus Schwab, quote, to accelerate the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, unquote. And then concurrently, there was a UN-NATO agreement that was in the works and was implemented in 2023, resulting in what could be described as the UN-WEF NATO Triad, largely responding to the request for global governance. While this agreement was described as a dialogue, NATO is increasingly embedded in the UN system and allegedly endorsing, quote, peace, support, and crisis management, unquote. And there's a quote I'd like to read that was from NATO, given in July of 2023, and it states, the complexity of today's security challenges has required a broader dialogue between NATO and the UN. This has led to reinforced cooperation and liaison agreements between the staff of the two organizations, as well as UN specialized agencies. So you can see these fingers or antennas of the UN just working everywhere and with so many other organizations.
Right. One other point about this UNWEF NATO Triad is that it's signifying the United Nations system becoming privatized. It's moving more and more in the direction of a public-private partnership, which is basically the melding together of government entities and large corporations into something that's a third kind of animal.
Which we're seeing a lot now in many sectors around the world and in the U.S.
Right, right, exactly. But to bring this to a close, NATO is ultimately poised, and they're being groomed to, I believe, become the world military. And they are in the process always of accumulating more members. And what I foresee in the future, if things continue to go the way that they are, is that they will be essentially united with the United Nations Blue Helmets and their other peacekeeping forces, so that we eventually have a single force once there has been enough merger of the other political entities around the world so that we have a single military, because once again, one is the magic number. Without two or more distinct entities, you can never have opposition except from within.
And I can see forced membership easily happening into NATO with countries that are not necessarily interested.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. So that they can participate in other parts of the non-military system. Now, it's entirely possible that entire countries will eventually be conscripted and drafted in the way that individuals have been in the past.
So with that, let's move on to our next global organization, the European Union, and a bit about the history of the European Union, which is known as the EU, with the aim of ending the frequent and bloody conflicts that culminated in the Second World War. European politicians began the process of building what we know today as the EU in the mid-1940s. The European Coal and Steel Community, founded in 1951, was the first step, and then in 1957, the Treaty of Rome was established, and then in 1957, the Treaty of Rome established the European Economic Community and a closer cooperation in Europe. The Treaty on European Union was signed in the Netherlands, and the European Union, as we know now, officially entered into force in 1993. Border-free travel and the euro were implemented within the next few years. So I would suggest that while there are definite benefits to merging multiple countries in one controlling body, there are also risks with moving towards a centralized government. And one of those risks being the loss of state autonomy and, for the citizens, of course, personal liberties. It's all about the greater good of the whole and not the individual, whether it's states or people. Take, for instance, the United Kingdom or Britain. They worked for years to exit the EU and finally did so in 2020. The movement was coined Brexit for British exit. And this was not a lightly made move. The separation most likely would affect things like trade and tariffs, the land border between them and Ireland, agriculture and fishing policy, and security problems, just to name a few. However, the UK persisted in wanting autonomy from the EU, and whether it ended up being a good thing or not is still debatable. It depends on who you talk to. So that's kind of the case where one country decided they were going to exit and successfully did that, which was a very long, drawn-out process. So while I was researching the EU, I discovered that a large part of their agenda is the implementation of the Green New Deal. And very basically, because we are later going to extensively cover this topic, the Green New Deal is public policy that addresses climate change with such things as net zero carbon emission regulations, reducing roadway lanes to force more people into using public transport. These are called road diets, exclusion of fossil fuel sources, and weather modification, commonly referred to as geoengineering. And there are other names too, but this green agenda is chock full of flowery phrases like environmental and social justice, expanding access to clean air and water, raising wages and building climate resilience, and creating millions of jobs needed to solve the climate crisis. You get the point. There are all ways of manipulating their agenda and making it sound like it's a positive thing. And honestly, some of it is. But I think
ostensibly.
Right. Exactly. Interestingly, it appears that the UN took up the green agenda in 2009 with a report written by the United Nations Environment Program calling for a global Green New Deal in response to the multiple global crises of fuel, food, and financial in 2008. I see a pattern developing. Never let a good crisis go to waste. What I found just about everywhere I looked was some form of the Green New Deal being pushed by the EU with connections to the World Economic Forum. The EU has passed most of the Fit for 55 legislative package that defines the sustainable actions required to achieve their 2030 target goals. Sound familiar? There are phrases on their website such as on the path to climate neutrality, or making transport sustainable for all, and leading the green industrial revolution. They created Next Generation EU, which sets the blueprint for a greener, more digital, more resilient future with a connected recovery and resilience plan, a scorecard, a facility, and a task force to implement this agenda. And I found another connection to the WEF. In 2023, the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, announced that the Green Deal Industrial Plan, or Net Zero Industry Act, was in development at her speech to the World Economic Forum at their annual summit in Davos. And I am really excited to dig into the Green New Deal when that comes up, because it is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really will be. The European Union is very interesting, I think, because you can see a real model of how they want to consolidate power at the continent level scale. And the Green New Deal is something that is going to be facilitated quite a bit if they're actually able to create an entity that encompasses all of the European nations, so that they all have to adhere to the same law, to the same constitution, and so on.
And that's the road they're headed towards.
Yeah. And I thought Brexit was actually a little bit interesting, because during my own research, what I've noticed is that a lot of the thinking behind globalization does seem to come out of the UK in particular. The United Kingdom was imperialistic in a way most other continental nations of Europe were not during the colonial era. They had the empire on which the sun never set, and the biggest companies that were precursors to today's corporate giants, like the Hudson Bay Company, they were British companies. And so I can't help but wonder if Britain knows what the score is, and they might actually be trying to distance themselves to retain their own autonomy, because they know it's happening via the European Union to the rest of Europe, and they don't want to be caught in the same dragnet.
Well, I find the whole Brexit deal very encouraging for other nation states, because it is possible to separate yourself from this huge conglomerate.
It is, but it's going to become increasingly difficult.
Right.
Because there are only certain people who can make the formal decisions to separate, and those are the people in the constitutional bodies of our governments. The rest of us can want to separate as much as we want, but without being able to communicate with and influence that to the decision-making bodies that actually control that, then we're basically sort of along for the ride. And that is one of the strategies here, is to basically make sure that these decisions are made by a small number of people representing huge numbers of constituents, and then make sure those people are controlled. What they decide will be transmitted for everyone that they represent.
That's why we have to be so adamant and work towards getting representation from someone who will promote what most of us want.
Right. And so that's increasingly difficult, because the game is rigged, you know, both through the election process and then through co-option of people once they become elected.
Exactly.
I was listening to someone on another podcast last night who suggested that in the U.S. Congress, there may be as few as two or three people who actually vote their conscience. That's a very sobering figure, because that's clearly a minority with the power to basically do nothing, the way that our current electoral politics work, right?
Well, not necessarily. I would argue that they are doing something. It's not what we want.
Well, sure. They are doing something. And even that small two or three person minority is doing something. That's better than nothing, because they may be having indirect effects where they are. But the whole plan right now that I'm seeing is basically to take institutions that are designed to be democratic and to be constitutional and represent the people, and find any possible way around them, so that they can be co-opted and made to serve a globalist agenda.
Yeah, so I was going to say, either around them or through them, and take them over.
Yes.
Well, Peter, this has been a lot of information on this show, and I think it's becoming pretty clear that it is up to we the people to make a change for the better in order to gain our freedoms and our liberties back. And if we don't step up and start making a difference and start vocalizing, then this is just going to continue to happen. I want to thank everyone for joining us. This has been really informative. We're continuing to see this interconnectedness and how all of these global organizations are intertwined and working together. Please join us on our next show, where we are going to cover the International Criminal Court, which I would argue is the world's first permanent international criminal court, kind of heading towards a world court, and the African Union. Have you ever heard of that? We're going to find out a lot about that on the next show. See you then. And as always, make freedom your single issue.
You cannot escape what's mandated. If you don't stop, it will be an end to our democracy. Are you not satisfied with what we provided? Are you not aware of the danger you pose to the will of the majority? You must understand that we are here to help. Give up your guns. Give up your mind. Give up your soul.